Hello, I'm Andy Berry, the host of Metro Morning on CBC Radio 199.1 in Toronto. And this is our weekly podcast, Toronto This Week. It features highlights of our local and regional shows on CBC, shows like Here and Now, Ontario Morning, and Fresh Air. But first, here's an item from Metro Morning. All morning we've heard from commuters, politicians, and experts, all of them sharing their thoughts on transit in this city. Now we would like to take a step back, go broad, and talk about vision, specifically with the people who need it the most to get your vote. Toronto Mayor David Miller and City Councillor Jane Pitfield are both on the line. Mr. Mayor, good morning.
Good morning, Andy.
Ms. Pitfield, hello.
Hello.
They're here to tell us how they envision the future of transit in this city.
Well, I think there's two things we have to talk about, Andy, what we need to do and how you pay for it. We have a plan TTC adopted recently called Transit City, which calls for running buses in their own right-of-way like Ottawa and running streetcars in their own right-of-way like Spadina or St. Clair across the city. And that has to be the backbone of our future plans because it brings rapid transit in a real way, in an affordable way, to neighborhoods across the city that don't have it.
If Mr. Miller is talking about Transit City, Ms. Pitfield, you've been talking about a balanced approach, which is not necessarily car city, but it seems to some it means more cars. Could you explain what your balanced approach means?
It doesn't mean more cars, but what it means is that we not only need to make public transit more reliable and go where people can actually use it and need it, but we need to also improve road conditions for all vehicles. And what I mean by that is so that we don't have these parking lots created on the Don Valley Parkway and the 401. There's great frustration, and some people at this point have no choice but to use cars. We certainly should have more than one person in each car.
Rick Ducharme said last year that the problems plaguing the TTC really ought to be resolved by people just going to work earlier. Not exactly a strategy that's going to go over well with commuters. We need something to actually fix the problem. Do you have an alternative, Mr. Miller?
Well, flex time, of course, is part of a solution in certain areas. But what we're doing in the plan that I endorse in the next 4 years, we're going to take significant steps to implement, is to bring rapid transit to neighborhoods. In the way I described, the challenge for us is affordability. You know, under Bill Davis, David Peterson, and Bob Ray, the province used to share 75% of the TTC's capital costs and 50% of the operating costs. We've made big strides, and I got to applaud Premier McGuinty and former Prime Minister Paul Martin, made big strides in the past 3 years in getting the other governments back in the business of funding transit, but it's not permanent. It has to be permanent. If we want to talk about any vision to make our city work by investing in transit, just like every other country in the world, we need senior governments to recognize the importance to them and us of investing in public transit.
Ms. Pitfield, in the last municipal election, last mayor election, John Tory, who is roughly in the position you're in right now, took off after Mayor Miller when the subject of tolls came up at Nathan Phillips Square. We were hearing about that a little earlier. Why don't you just freely associate to the word tolls, the part they could or should play, call them tolls, call them congestion fees, as our panel suggested earlier. Is this a solution for you?
It won't be immediately. What I'd rather do is improve the existing transit and make it more reliable so that people will actually choose it.
But
and,
in order to pay for that...
On the topic of rapid transit and streetcar right-of-ways, I really think it should be in high-density corridors.
I'd like you both to address the subject of tolls, if you could, because somehow we have to pay for the improvements you just called for. So you say not immediately, but then when, Ms. Pitfield?
Well, federal and provincial governments should be using taxes they collect on fuel to fund the transportation network. And the other thing we really need to do, Andy, is we need to get on board with the rest of the 905. And we need taxing powers and authority and agreement between transit operators. I think there's been political resistance to work with the 905. It's ridiculous. We're one big GTA, and we need to have a GTA fare card. I think it's being announced today. It's a pilot, and Toronto should get on board with different options. And when you ask when, it would be something that I would put off for now. If I did propose it, it would be something that the people of this city also support. And it would also, I would show them exactly where the money collected would go and how it would fund the transit network.
Mr. Miller, I'm sure you'd love to talk about polls again. It was so much fun last time.
Well, as you know, Andy, I've had 3 years to think about it. I don't think tolls are a Toronto solution.
Why not?
Because we have one highway coming in from the north, basically the north and the east, one from the west.
Well, arguably, that makes it easier to police them. If it costs £8 to get into the...
If you have tolls on those roads, people are going to choose to go through neighborhoods. We're a very different city than London, England. And the solutions are pretty clear. And it's not just in Toronto. Mayors across the country have agreed. We met in Toronto on September 22nd. In this country, we need a national transit strategy. We don't have one. And, you know, the federal government now is talking about clean air and smog. The single biggest way in large cities we can address smog is by properly funding transit so people can choose to take transit. That is the way to go. And moreover, when you talk about the gas tax, we're already paying those taxes.
I got to tell you, smog aside, the answers that are coming from both of you feel like fog to me. I have a hard time imagining how a voter would choose between you, given the platitudes we've heard from both of you. Are there no big ideas? We've talked constantly about big ideas in terms of dealing with transit in the city.
I have some big ideas. I think that we need to look at public-private partnerships for the unprofitable operations that we currently have in the TTC, and London, England has done this. They've added 30% of their network, which is delivered through the private sector, and it's not privatizing the TTC, it simply enhances. And I also think that we should never have stopped building subways, and I would advocate for a 25-year plan where we're building 2 kilometers a year.
And Andy, I can't agree with you. That what we're saying, or at least what I'm saying, it isn't the reality. I mean, we have to understand reality in this city. Our transit system is great for a city of about 1.5 million. I've been a TTC commissioner for years, and the challenge the TTC faces is very simple. Whether we want to build subways, streetcars in their own right-of-way, or busways, it takes funding. The funding used to exist. That's how we built our system. It stopped existing. And it has to be the first priority of the mayor. It certainly has been in my 3 years. That's why we have hundreds of new buses on the streets of this city. That's why they're hybrids. That's why we've been able to do the St. Clair streetcar right-of-way, because of the advocacy with Queen's Park and Ottawa that has paid for transit. That's how we're going to build a transit city. It does require funding, and privatizing it simply isn't the answer.
Just lastly, because we're going to be talking to Howard Moscow in just a few minutes. How about the political organization of the TTC? Rick Ducharme quit because he couldn't resolve the battles he had with their elected politicians. David Gunn said it was virtually impossible to do business when he was running the TTC because of political interference. Do we need a different structure, finally, for administering the TTC?
Yes, we do, and I've already advocated to change the commission to 5 citizens and 4 elected councillors. Andy, it's never been so political as it is right now, and those 9 commissioners are out of touch. They are not representing what the people of the city want, and we've got to get rid of the politics and get back to some good business management with people who know something about transit.
Andy, I couldn't disagree more. The people who are on the commission are elected. They're responsive to the voters of Toronto. That's as it should be. And certain decisions like where to cut routes have to be political. The TTC is exceptionally well run. It's the best managed transit system in North America, and the accountability in the end of any civil servant should be to elected officials, whether it's the TTC or the city's direct civil service. It should be to elected officials. That's who we elect, and that's how you have accountability to the people of Toronto.
David Miller, thank you.
Thank you.
Jane Pitfield, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Both candidates for the mayor in November's Toronto election will be casting our ballots in just over a month from now. If you'd like to cast anything from aspersions to flowers in their paths, you may do so via the Vox Box at 416-205-5807. I'm Andy Berry, and this is our weekly podcast, Toronto This Week. Now here's Matt Galloway with a highlight from this week's Here and Now.
In households across this city, children are hitting the books trying to get that homework done. For most kids and their parents, homework can be a real source of real stress. According to a new study, parents have a pretty good reason to be stressed out. The survey found, as I mentioned, that 2/3 of Canadian parents don't actually have the knowledge they need to help their kids with their homework. Paul Kappen is the president of the Canadian Council on Learning, and he's with me on the line to tell us more about this study. Paul, hello.
Good afternoon.
What questions did you ask parents about homework?
Well, actually, we asked them if they thought they had the competence, the knowledge necessary to help the children with their homework. We weren't asking them to make, we weren't making the judgment ourselves. We're asking them to make the judgment as to whether they had the confidence and the competence, and they said no.
2/3 of the parents flunk.
Well, they thought so. Isn't that interesting? They didn't have the confidence that they could do it. Probably because, as somebody was saying just now on your show, the subject matter changes, and from generation to generation, the standards grow over time, as they should, and our generation is less well-educated probably than the next generation coming up.
Are you surprised by that figure? Because it seems high, even if there are qualifying circumstances.
It is a little higher than I thought it would be, I must admit. But it shows that people, and we interviewed over 5,000 people, are quite honest about what they think they can do. But you probably hear people all the time saying, you know, that grade 4 or grade 5 mathematics is difficult, and when I'm asked a question, I refer to my wife or my husband or whatever the case may be, because they don't have the confidence to do it. I don't see this as bad news, however.
Why so? Because a lot of people would say that it is bad news, that if the parents can't help out the kids aren't going to be as strong in school.
That's because they're taking it personally, but it doesn't mean that the parents can't help their kids. And the issue is this. The role of parents is to help their children, is supporting a good work ethic, supporting love for learning, supporting problem solving, family discussion, reading to young children, and motivation. And actually, a lot of the standardized testing internationally shows that independent learners do better at standardized exams.
Mm.
So helping your children do the actual homework may not be to their advantage anyway.
This is interesting, because this is something we were talking about in the office earlier today, this idea that parents shouldn't get involved with the kids at all, that the kids should be able to make mistakes so that the teachers know who's struggling and who's not.
Well, they should be involved, but involved in terms of supporting good work ethic. So that your children does the homework and that they finish the homework is very important, that they take responsibility, but helping them to do it is another thing. Problem solving with children is important around the dinner table or the breakfast table, looking up a word in the dictionary together, understanding it together, and discussing things. Interesting that children whose parents read to them very young and who have discussions around the dinner table do quite well in reading exams, and just as well as in fact as children who come from wealthier families do.
What other information about homework did you pick up during this study?
Well, it was very interesting to me to see that parents think that the amount of homework given to their children is adequate, that more would not be necessary, and that they don't equate the quantity of homework with the quality of education.
That's surprising, because again, a lot of parents complain that the kids are coming home with too much to do.
Well, they don't say it's too little. They may think it's too much. And I think that's a very sophisticated view. It's very interesting that people understand that, because what it says to me is that it's not the mastery, only the subject material that parents are interested in for their children. It's the love of learning, the understanding of what's being imparted, and the participation in it. And I think that's another piece of good news, frankly.
What does this study say about the state of the country's education system? In doing this, do you think the Canadians feel confident and feel, proud of the education system?
Well, again, these are the views of Canadians. This is not an objective assessment by us, but what Canadians think of their own education system. It's curious that when you ask them the question, how well are the core skills and curriculum being imparted to children, probably not including provincial politics, but things like mathematics and science and history, the majority of Canadians think the schools are doing well, but very few say they're doing very well.
It's a fascinating study, certain to generate a lot of discussion. Appreciate you filling us in on some of the details, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Paul Kappen, the president of the Canadian Council on Learning. It has to be something that a lot of people are talking about. This is the time of the evening when people might be finishing up dinner, getting ready to sit down and help the kids out with the homework. Would be really interested to know whether you help out your kids with their homework. Do you feel like you can handle it? Are you struggling with that homework? I'm terrified of when my kids grow up and I have to do math questions. Do you think parents should stay away from the kids' homework altogether and let the kids float or sink on their own, I suppose? We'd love to know. You can give us a call. Call the telephone machine. It awaits. 416-205-2700, or you can send us an email, our email address here and now at toronto.cbc.ca. Tell us about your experiences with your kids' homework.
That was Matt Galloway, host of Here and Now, heard weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on CBC Radio 1, 99.1 in Toronto. I'm Andy Berry, and this is our weekly podcast, Toronto This Week. Now here's Jane Houghton with a highlight from this week's Ontario Morning.
A London area farm has captured a world record. McEachern Farms created the world's largest corn maze. This labyrinth of corn stalks is spread over 24 acres. It has a firefighter theme that includes the outline of an axe, a fire truck, and a firefighter. But that's not all. To tell us more, we've reached Dave McEachern. He's on the line from Glencoe. Good morning.
Yes, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Excellent.
So how did you feel when you found out that you'd broke this world record?
We were quite excited. We actually measured up the maze back at the beginning of August, end of July. We had some officials come and measure it and sent our package away to Guinness World Records, and it was a long, impatient wait till last Thursday evening. We finally had an email confirmation from them saying that we had indeed set a new record.
So I guess you had to do some research to find out what you'd have to do to set this new record.
That's right, and funny story, we did the research and found that the old record was 17 acres, so we thought, well, we could do a 20-acre maze and secure that, so we planned kind of around that 20-acre number, and the day that it was measured, it actually came out at 23, just under 23 and a half acres, and we were happy that we made it even bigger than we had thought. And then the next day we were reading an article, and it said that the current record was actually 22 point something.
So oh boy.
We did some more research, and someone in the meantime had broken the old record already. So, yeah, we were more than lucky.
That's a good thing you already had that plan in place.
That's right, yeah.
Now, what made you want to do this? It must be a lot of work to put together a maze.
It is. It's, a lot of people look at the picture of it and realize there's a whole lot of work goes into making it, but there's also a whole lot of work goes into to building up your business and marketing it and getting all that portion of it done too. But yeah, we started 3 years ago. I guess we were looking for something different to do on the farm. Times, not that they aren't better, too much better now, but times were pretty tough in agriculture. And I'd actually seen mazes done while I was at the University of Guelph doing some research on different projects, and saw the huge number of mazes that were through the United States and the UK, and thought maybe someday we'll give that a try. So I guess we have, and here we are.
Yeah. Now, why a firefighter theme?
Well, actually, my wife and I are both on our local volunteer fire department, and each year we try and come up with a different theme. And so this year we thought, let's do the firefighting theme. It kind of relates to most people. They recognize firefighters, and we thought that's kind of something fun and new to do.
So how do you actually do it? Is it all laid out on a graph paper or something?
Well, that's how we kind of started a couple of years ago. It was just with pencil and paper, and away we went. We've since moved on to the computer here finally, and I started doing the maps and the layout on our computer. A lot of people figure we use GPS to actually get it out into the field, but we don't. We do a whole lot of walking and putting out reference points, and when the corn starts growing, we start removing corn where we hope to have a path.
Oh, and then don't you have to check it, though? Do you have to get up in a plane or
something?
Well,
that's the thing. I don't have a plane that I can just go up in whenever I want, so there isn't much checking until I'm all done. So it's kind of
the flight
up can be kind of nervous, especially this year. We put a logo into our corn maze. It's a charity of Muscular Dystrophy Canada. We put their logo in, which is the full words Muscular Dystrophy Canada, and three puzzle pieces that are interlinked. And I'll tell you, when I was making those out in the field, I was hoping that I was getting it right. And when we went flying over it for the first time, it was kind of, I was anxious to see that, and it turned out wonderful, so I was very happy.
And so did you cheer when you saw it?
Yeah, actually the pilot that was flying me, he's flown me up each year over the maze for some photos, and he was, as we got closer, I remember him just saying, holy cow, he said, that's a lot bigger than normal.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And so now when someone goes into this maze, how long does it take the person to complete it?
Well, because it is so big, we made three different routes in the maze. There is a long, medium, and short route. The longest route takes anywhere around an hour, give or take 10 or 15 minutes either way. The shorter routes take half an hour to 45 minutes. So it's all, it's not too long, and it's not over in a few minutes either. So.
Yeah. Has anyone ever gotten lost inside?
Well, that's the whole idea, I guess, of going into the maze is to try and get lost. But we haven't had to go hunting for, for too many people over the past couple of years. This year, because it is bigger, there's people have taken a little bit longer, but no one's really got lost that they gave up or couldn't find their way out. So, No, it's been good that way.
How would you know if they were lost? Would they call you on their cell phone?
Actually, when people come to the maze, we get their names and we record when each person goes in, what time it is, and then that's how we have an idea how long it takes to go through, and so we know if it's taking someone quite a bit longer than the normal time to go through, we can go in and have a look for them. I've gone in a couple of times and people have been almost out the exit, so that's how we kind of keep track and account for everybody that way.
Final question for you, Dave. Is this the way you make a living now instead of farming?
This past weekend it probably could be, but we've been very busy. But no, farming still is what we do, and it's still our career of choice. So this is, I guess, the nice thing about this is just to get people out into the country, and hopefully they can learn a little bit about farming or agriculture when they come out here. So.
Great. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Dave McEachern runs the McEachern Farms Corn Maze. It's the largest corn maze in the world. It's in Glencoe, southwest of London. If you want to check it out, you want to see the maze, you can go to thecornmaze.ca.
That was Jane Houghton with a highlight from Ontario Morning. It's heard weekday mornings from 6 to 8:30 throughout much of southern and central Ontario on CBC Radio 1. And that will do it for our weekly podcast, Toronto This Week. You can hear all our shows live on CBC Radio 1. If you're in Toronto, that's a 99.1, and live on the web at cbc.ca/Toronto. And don't forget, much of our network programming is also now available via podcast. You'll find that at cbc.ca/podcast. We're also looking for some feedback on our podcast, and you can email us at metromorning@toronto.cbc.ca. I'm Andy Berry, the host of Metro Morning. We're heard weekday mornings from 6 to 8:30 on CBC Radio 1, 99.1 in Toronto. For all of us here at CBC Radio in Toronto, have a good week. We'll have another podcast for you next weekend.